satellite receiver just gets overloaded from 25 watts, but it doesn't get permanently damaged. So he says, I wonder if this will be a problem on the house and how people deal with it, as I know most hams have multiple receiver and antennas. Let me drop for a second. Okay, so basically, Chris is sort of asking what happens when you have a lot of antennas up on your shack area and you have a bunch of live radio receivers and transmitters, and how much damage can you do? And I'm sure a lot of people out there have experienced the joy of all kinds of problems with too much RF getting back into their shack one way or another. Unfortunately, you know, the answer tends to be the same as Facebook's entry for relationships. It's complicated. It sort of depends upon a whole bunch of things. It depends upon the distance between your transmitting antenna and your receiving antenna, on the difference in the frequencies that the transmitter is transmitting on and the receiver is receiving on, and how the receiver has been designed. Receivers can deal with signal overload a number of different ways. If it's very well designed, it can just attenuate them down to an acceptable level. Other times, it can descend, and so you'll start to get more noise in the background, and it won't quite lock on as well to a strong signal. And in the worst-case scenarios, it'll blow out the front end. There are a lot of MOSFETs and such that are used on the front end of the RF amplification chain. And if there's no surge protection, those things will blow, and you'll have to get it fixed. So it sort of depends on what the radio design is. Some are more bulletproof than others. Let me drop for a sec. Now, I'd like to throw out the subject to the audience because, again, I'm thinking that just about everyone has had experiences where they've either blown out their front end or descent their front end, or maybe were successful. But I thought I would introduce another little variation because, unfortunately, I really do like science, and if it's a little theoretical, if it's too theoretical for you, I understand. But it's the difference between near field and far field. Most of what we learn is about far field radiation. That pretty much means that at least your, whatever it is about two wavelengths away from your radiating antenna. In the far field, everything is like it says in the book. You have an electromagnetic wave that is temporally in sync so that when the peak of the electrical field occurs at the same exact time that the magnetic field occurs. And the signal will attenuate by 1 over the square of the distance from the radiator. Let me drop for a sec. The fascinating thing in my mind is what happens before those two wavelengths. Now, I'm using these terms, wavelengths, because that's how it works. As long as your radiating antenna is less than a wavelength long. So most of our antennas are either a half wavelength dipoles, or quarter-wave verticals, or some variation of that scheme. So most of our antennas, and some of them are even electronically shortened and then mechanically shortened and then electrically resonated. So for all those people, all those antennas, two times the wavelength is where it becomes far-field. Between 1 and 2 wavelength distance is an intermediate zone, and in the first one wavelength distance from the antenna, you have something magical called the near field. just let me drop for a sec. In the near field, all bets are off, and most of what you've read about radios don't apply. Instead of being temporally in sync with the magnetic field and the electronic field having the peak at the same exact time, you can have a quadrature alignment. You can have the maximum of the magnetic field while the electrical field goes to zero. So there's a degree of inherent decoupling in the electric field and the magnetic field in the near field. And it actually acts the same way that RF or alternating current works in a transformer. And it's actually the first half of a wavelength is called the reactive field. And you have capacitive coupling and inductive coupling and all manner of interesting phenomena. If you take a dozen antennas and put them and resonate them for a certain frequency, at least somewhere in the far field, your transmitting antenna will not change at all. It's totally unaffected. If you place them in the near field and you resonate them, you can actually increase the loading of your transmitting antenna because they are coupled by something more than just routine electromagnetic radiation. So the near field is sort of a fascinating, exciting, and strange thing. The laws of physics tend to suggest that the electric field and the magnetic field shouldn't be in sync when they are created in the near field because the laws of magnetism and electricity would put them in quadrature, which is what they are in the reactive field. But something goes on from the reactive field to the intermediate field to the far field that causes the electric and magnetic fields to become coupled and to become temporally in alignment. And also, an interesting thing, at least to me, is that the attenuation of electromagnetic waves in alignment are 1 over r squared. But the near field electric and magnetic fields range anywhere from attenuating by 1 over r cubed to 1 over r to the fifth. So that's another reason why you're not going to see that much past the near field. They dissipate so quickly because of the high orders of exponential factors that they dissipate, and all they leave behind is that electromagnetic wave that we all know and love. So I find near field
repeater timeout. Repeater timeout cancel.
Sorry, I babbled away. Anyway, if anyone would like to discuss near field, far field, or if they would just like to give their opinions and experiences with desensing and overloading front end, please feel free. Give me your call sign and your name.
C2IS with a comment.
Yes, Bill.
Just going to mention that a while back, not too long ago, I happen to have a cellular modem device. It's basically like a MiFi kind of device. And I happen to have it next to the radio that I'm talking on now. And I keyed up at 50 watts. And that thing stopped working. So I did not wait to see if it would straighten itself out. I turned it off. And then I think the next day I turned it on again, and it was fine. It was to pass data and so forth. But I thought it was interesting because these are things that get deployed in remote locations, and anytime one of them hangs up like that, it becomes a service issue where somebody would have to go out and reboot it. So I suddenly thought, like, oh, you know, what happens if this thing is near a radio that keys up at some point? I wonder how many service issues that's causing for me. AC2IS.
AC2GS. Well, that's interesting. I know that at one point I had a problem mounting my fan dipole reasonably well off the ground. It was kind of drooping excessively to the point that way too much of the RF was getting, was just being radiated inside my shack. And every so often I would have computers reset and modems reset and such. So, you know, I would assume that these commercial and computer-related pieces of equipment, it, as someone mentioned earlier about the wall wards, it depends upon the degree of RF shielding that they spend the time and the effort to design in. You know, they're designed not to generate hash and noise, but maybe they're not designed to take the a frontal assault of 25 watts of RF anywhere near them. So that's an interesting story. I've experienced way too much RF in my shack and interesting things that went blink and on and off. But thankfully, once I raised the fan dipoles to a proper length, those things went away. Yes, Wesley.
Discussion and Splinter's information could be referred to. The ear field could be represented by two regions. One is non-radiative, which is reactive, and the other one is radiative, which is Fresnel. And then we have a far field. Any way we could represent calculation, some of them lambda divided by 2 pi. Although, if we want to find the near field, it's relatively close. And there are different opinions. Some of the people say that the far field began at the distance of 3 lambda from the source, with lambda being radiation wavelength. We can speculate on whatever we want. Now, we also have Fresnel zone as the Fresnel diffraction, and then actually the same, but for shorter frequencies. For me, interesting is that everything that is related to waveguides or, say, the strip lines were a sandwich of air and the conductor or air or the insulator or two insulators with different properties makes an interface that is able to carry on the way that under the Brewster angle tilt, and then it travels in that interface. That's a part of science. If you go to lessons of MIT, let me drop. I remember I sent you one of them. There was the link. I'm trying to find that link right now. Hold on. Oh, yeah. CEM lectures. CEM lectures. Let me open up quickly that one. Okay, videos. Lectures, and there is one particular one, surface wave, but actually all of the channels, CEM, Charlie England Mary lectures, is a channel that makes explanation of near field, far field, and the way that never radiates. It simply sleep itself in under the Brewster language angle into that a conductive non-conductive for interface. But then after that, after we pass Fresnel refractions, then we have a far field, and in far field, the properties of the wave are more close into the properties of a wave that is outside of far field. I would like to hear your own impression about the difference between behavior of the wave in near field, the regular electromagnetic wave, not transverse electromagnetic wave, and far field. Then to exchange.
AC2GS. Okay, Wesley. I appreciate your enthusiasm for this. I don't want to go too blue sky. It's a wee bit too early in the evening for everyone. When you were talking about the Fraunhofer lens and the Fresnel lens and the Fraunhofer diffraction, that's the generalized equation for an antenna that's more than a wavelength long. As long as you keep the wire antenna, whatever form of antenna you have, at less than a wavelength long, you can simplify the Fraunhofer equation so that it's much simpler, in that half of a wavelength away from the radiator is the reactive phase, another half of a wavelength away is then the radiative phase, then from one wavelength length to a second to two times the wavelength length is the intermediate phase, and everything from two wavelengths away from the radiating antenna is the far field. And the whole point that I'm trying to say is there's some kind of interesting and yet very confusing transformation that takes place between the reactive phase and the far field, in that in the reactive phase you have electric and magnetic fields that are not necessarily coupled with each other, and they're in quadrature delay, which can be somewhat confusing, and they fall off at anywhere from 1 over r cubed to 1 over r to the fifth. Whereas those waves dissipate rather quickly because of that characteristic, and all that's left behind is these apparent temporally in-phase electric and magnetic fields that then propagated 1 over r squared. So I think discussing Fraunhofer lens and Fresnel lens and the diffraction is, you know, if people are interested, they can certainly go, and I will give a link to the Wikipedia page, and there's YouTubes as well. But I just wanted to kind of whet their appetite for the concept of near field.
What I would do is I would exclude everything that is far field in order to concentrate on near field. So the far field is the region which the field acts normal to electromagnetic radiation, in the region that is dominated by electrical magnetic fields with electric dipole characteristics. In far field, region of an antenna radiated power decreases as the square of the distance, and absorption of the radiation does not feed back to the transmitter. Let me drop. In the far field region, each part of electromagnetic field, which is electric and magnetic components of it, is produced by associated with a change in the other part, and the ratio of electric and magnetic field intensifies simply the wave impedance. But we would also say that near field region, the electric and magnetic fields can exist independently of each other, and one type of the field can dominate the other side. I already mentioned one property of the near field. Let me jump.
Wesley?
Go ahead.
I think I covered some aspects of that. Theoretical impedance for empty space or even air is about 377 ohms of resistive impedance. The calculated impedance in the near field is much more complicated and dependent upon the frequency of the alternating current. And that's also available at the Wikipedia. But it depends. I mean, there's a lot of fascinating things to be interested in. For whatever reason, my primary interest is how it gets from one to the other. I could understand if you're more interested in either the reactive or the radiative phase. But it's the transitions and the complete lack so far of me finding any really good information about these transitions that fascinates me.
Do I
ask where? Yes, Bill.
I understand that antennas can be, quote unquote, electronically steered. Right? If you have two antennas that are, within the near field distance of each other, if they're within a wavelength, you can feed signals into them. They're out of phase, and steer the signal coming out of those antennas. Is there anything about this study of the near field that tells us sort of how or why that happens?
To my knowledge, there's not really that much available. And at the distances that they usually use are probably more at the intermediate phase field than the truly reactive field. I think it's just technically a lot easier to adjust the phase relationships of a relatively close set of antenna radiators. You can probably do a degree of beam adjusting by putting them even farther apart. It's relatively simple constructive and destructive interference that's going on.
Okay. What I think would be practically easy to understand about the near field. When we put the finger into the near field and move out towards the far field with, let's say, cell phone or some high frequency devices, the capacitive sensing sink, all the distortion due to the field, to that field, is what indicates us being in closed field. So the interaction with the medium or, say, body capacitor can cause energy to deflect back to the source as occurs in a reactive near field, or the interaction with the medium can fail to return energy back to the source, but cause a distortion in the electromagnetic wave that deviates significantly from that found in free space. So, when we are not able to interfere with it, then this is a border. This is the transition between near field and far field. Intuition.
AC2GS. Well, yeah, Wesley, I think I mentioned that one of the interesting characteristics in the near field is that it allows for capacitive and inductive coupling. So that if you were to stick a resonant antenna in the near field of a transmitter, you would notice that the loading on the transmitter would increase because at those distances there can be inductive and capacitive coupling, and so effectively you're changing the loading of the transmitter. Once you get into the far field and it's purely an electromagnetic wave phenomenon, there's no longer any inherent magnetic or electrical separate coupling of capacitance or inductance, and you don't have the loading consequences. in the far fields that you do in the near field. And, I mean, that's one of the reasons why we have these touch tablets, because they use capacitive coupling nearby. But yeah, that's a phenomenon that I think I addressed to one degree or another, the difference between the near field and the far field.
I do agree with you. Yes, you said that. I was trying only to add to it. So if we have reactive part of near field, which is lambda divided by 2 pi, then, then we have the radiative one that is with the transition zone taking about 2 wavelengths. Then we say 50% of those 2 wavelengths, which would be 1 wavelength, would be the transition zone. So the transition zone is not one point. It's a significant part of the near field region, but it belongs to the near field region. It doesn't belong to far field region. So the maximum overall dimension on the surface antenna is a prime factor determining the boundary where the far field generally starts at the distance of 2D square divided by lambda out to infinity, if I said it properly. And to action.
Yeah, Wesley, again, that's the generalized equation that can be simplified if you're using a radiating device that's less than a wavelength. It's a transition. There's no sharp edges to the reactive field, the radiative field, followed by the intermediate field, until you get to the far field, when everything kind of settles down. Everything is sort of in flux. So as you progress through these, it gets closer and closer to what we're all used to in the behavior of RF waves.
So how would you describe the difference of the transition zone in the near field to the near field? I mean, how near field, the near field region that has a reactive and radiative component in it differs with transition zone and switching?
Well, Wesley, as I mentioned before, as long as you keep the radiating antenna below one wavelength, then in the first half wavelength is what's called the reactive field, which is where there is a significant degree of both capacitive and inductive coupling, where transformers do their magic, because transformers actually are dealing in the reactive field of an alternating current, and that's how they transfer their power from primaries to the secondaries. And by loading the secondary, you are able to load the primary, which is a near field effect. If you go another half of a wavelength away, it becomes less likely to inductively couple, and you get some capacitive coupling in the radiative field. Then at one wavelength distance, it's a kind of mishmash, vaguely somewhere in between of the intermediate, where there's some qualities that are more consistent with the far field and some with the reactive field, and things haven't kind of settled down completely. There's still a degree of decoupled magnetic and electric fields that are dissipating at 1 over R to the 5th power and 1 over R to the 3rd power that haven't quite dissipated yet. And beyond 2 wavelengths, all those decoupled magnetic and magnetic and electric fields have dissipated because of that attenuation equation, and you're left with the far field. I don't want to kind of beat on this dead horse too long, because I'd like to get to some other things tonight.
So let's wrap it up. You In other words, you're saying that when you have a two windings of the transformer, air transformer, and you don't see the interaction between those two windings any longer, that's where the near fields end?
Yes, but when you get past the when you get into the intermediate fields, you have a significant degradation in the ability for it to couple and for any kind of tapping of that field to elicit a change in the load of the originating transmitter.
My last question is that phenomena between the two windings frequency dependent or size dependent? That means no matter what is the size of the two coils in air transformer, the transition zone starts from given point. And it's wide, but it starts from given point. It doesn't matter. It matters on the frequency that is delivered. And to exchange.
Again, not quite sure what you're getting at here. The number of turns are probably more related with the amount of, given the frequency, because unfortunately it's not constant, it's driven by the frequency, the amount of magnetic flux that's able to be transferred from the primary to the secondary. So if you're trying to transfer a great deal of current, you want a lot more copper than if you don't. But again, it's kind of messy because a frequency has its effect on the required number of a wire windings for a given amount of power transfer.
In your field, the current and the power, it gives you a certain amount of the magnetic field and electric field around the coil. So if you're dealing with two coils that are making air transformer, and you have a huge power and huge size of it, we should say, no, it doesn't matter, because what is important is the wavelength. It's the wavelength that determines the near field region and the transition zone. However, is it true? And to Asia.
Okay, we're going to put a cap on this one tonight, Wes. We can go back to it. With most transformers, my sensibility is that the distance between the windings are very, very small. So in the case of just about any normally designed transformer for any frequency, you're pretty much already in the reactive field, not anywhere near the far field. It's just, think in terms of a 60 hertz transformer. Can you imagine how far you'd have to get to be in the far field for something like that?
Yeah, I do agree with you. We're trying to wrap it up. Thank you very much, and we can talk about it later. Thank you.
AC2GX. Okay, thanks a lot, Wesley. I appreciated the conversation. But let's get on to the depressing stuff. And again, some people don't like the depressing stuff. I'm sorry. I don't know what to tell you guys. There's always the VFO. Anyway, government public officials have been playing ping pong with the question, should all people wear facial coverings when traveling? This week, the suggestion is to actually wear one. But let's be accurate about even this recommendation. The masks that health providers need to limit their risk of infection are called N95 masks. They allegedly only protect against about 95% of viral particles. Infectious lab hospitals use a much more stringent facial mask. Surgical masks are not meant to be protective to the wearer. They are designed to limit any infection from the wearer to surgical patients. The coronavirus is approximately 125 nanometers wide. That is approximately 1/2000 of the size of the width of a human hair. Now, cloth masks, paper masks, and even plastic masks have pores that are much, much larger than the diameter of these coronavirus particles. So, these masks, or cloth facial covering, as they are being called, are more to protect your neighbor from you than yourself from your neighbor. Now, some believe that it will act as a reminder not to touch your face. We will see with our 2020 hindsight if that works out that way, because some people seem to endlessly fidget with adjusting their face coverings to get them as comfortable as possible, and often touch their face excessively while wearing these facial masks. There is no single solution or policy that will get us through this coronavirus pandemic, but there is one thing that every American should be doing, if possible, and that's wearing a face mask whenever you're likely to come into contact with others. Let me drop for a sec. Soon after the first cases of COVID-19 were reported in China and elsewhere in January, people were understandably curious about the usefulness of face masks for stopping its spread. There is apparently solid evidence for face masks helping to stop the spread of the flu, but there are mixed evidence when it comes to coronaviruses like SARS, a close relative of the virus behind COVID-19, which is also known as SARS-CoV-2. Respirator masks like the N95 can filter out breathable germs, but have drawbacks, namely that they're hard to wear for very long times and aren't well fitted for people with facial hair and for small children. These are the primary masks a healthy person would wear to prevent catching an illness from others. Surgical masks, the sort you'd normally see in a hospital, are easier to use, but are typically worn by sick people in an effort to avoid infecting others. As recently as early March, U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams warned that wearing masks could actually increase the risk of catching the virus. Alongside these warnings, they also maintained that masks were in short supply for healthcare workers who needed them most because of the public's hoarding of them, a contradictory message to say the least. We now know that the virus can spread before people start feeling sick and may even spread from people who never feel sick at all. So simply not feeling sick isn't a guarantee that you're not contagious. If people can be contagious without knowing it, then it makes sense for everyone to wear a mask, whether they feel sick or not. Let me drop for a second. We're also getting more evidence for the benefits of mask wearing. Places whose governments did encourage mask wearing among the public early on in their respective outbreaks, such as Taiwan and South Korea, have consistently handled the coronavirus better than others, with fewer reported cases. Research published recently in Nature Medicine found evidence in the lab using human volunteers that face masks can reduce the transmission of flu and previous versions of coronavirus. You should still avoid touching your face, frequently wash or sanitize your hands, and of course, stay home as much as possible. People have shared instructions for how to make their own masks and reuse them safely, and there is research suggesting that even masks made from cotton t-shirts provide some protection against respiratory viruses, though to a lesser extent than surgical masks. On Friday afternoon, the president said that the CDC is now recommending the public wear cloth masks, though he said he didn't plan to wear one himself. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
AC2IS, I'd like to talk about ventilators at some point. AC2IS.
Yeah, sure, Bill. You know, my game plan is I have one other story related to coronavirus and then the unfortunate statistics, and then I'll just open the floor to anything that anyone wants to talk about related to the coronavirus, okay?
KV2NBB.
Yes, Bob.
Yes, Roy, I have a my neighbor gave me one, like, paper mask, and so far I've worn it twice, which maybe that's already too many times. It doesn't seem like I can wash this thing. It's like paper, and it would probably just fall apart, that's my guess. So I'm wondering if I should ever wear it again,
and I got somebody else on order, some kind of cloth mask. And so, yeah, I'm guessing maybe I shouldn't be wearing this thing at all anymore, but I just see what you have to say about that.
Yeah, Bob. Unfortunately, paper masks are the cheapest and the least likely to be recyclable. The polypropylene plastic and the cloth masks can be salvaged repeatedly. There's a whole bunch of different technologies and techniques that people are using. I tend to prefer, if you're going to do that, to kind of soak it in a 70% isopropyl alcohol solution for a couple minutes until it's nice and wet, and then pull it out of that little bath and let it air dry for a couple hours. Then it should be as good as new for the most part. But the paper ones will just degrade, and it won't provide you much service beyond a few attempts. I would hold off for the cloth, and worst comes to worst, you probably have something in your house that would be better than a somewhat dissolving piece of paper mask.
It's like just wrapping a scarf around my face if I can't find come up any better like that, Roy.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's not the best, but it's probably better than a degrading paper mask.
Very good. Thanks, Roy. I'll be hanging out. Maybe I'll have more questions later.
I heard a partial call sign. If someone had any questions on this particular subject, please give me your call sign and your name. Okay, what's your question? Okay, unfortunately, your signal is kind of breaking up like you have an open wire in your microphone or something. I'm assuming that the question is the leaf blowers, whether they're blowing around viral particles. I would tend to think not. Viral particles don't really like non-living things for very long. So the dead leaves and such probably wouldn't provide it any defense. So they would probably deteriorate reasonably soon. And once they get stuck on the leaves, blowing the leaves around, I think the chances of the little droplets coming off of them and flying back in the air are not really that big. So as much as these leaf blower guys can annoy people with the noise, I think the risk, at least what I understand for that type of situation, is not significant. Basically, the viral particles don't just kind of fly off on their own. What happens is there's a collection of thousands of viral particles in your saliva and your mucus and your spittle and such. And when you talk and when you cough and when you sneeze, sneeze, you spray these little lobules that are filled with viral particles. So the cloth will hopefully soak up most of them and stop them from their travels to another person or to a nice solid surface where someone else can touch it and then touch their face.
Okay, thank you.
WS2N?
Yes, Paul.
Good evening, Warren. I would say about 80% of the people out here in Suffolk, well, where I am anyway, when you go to the store now wearing masks or some kind of covering, which I think is good. Right from the beginning, I started wearing it early on, and, you know, I would say maybe 5%, you know, maybe three or four weeks ago at the most had masks. Now 80%, if not more. And I think it's good because people recognize that you want to stay away. I notice people are staying further away from one another. It seems to be going better. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, Paul. I mean, there are beneficial effects and there are detrimental effects. And only with 20/20 hindsight are we going to, after this is all over, figure out whether it was ultimately all for the best or the worst or somewhere in between. Because you can make cases for either approach. As long as you do not walk around with the feeling that you're Superman because you have a mask and you're protected, then I'm fine with the mask. I hope that people don't take it as an invisible shield around them and make foolish decisions about social distancing. But, you know, as long as you don't fiddle with the mask and don't assume that it's going to give you superpowers, I'm fine with the masks of any kind. Or they're not even really pushing the concept of calling it a mask. They're calling it a cloth covering.
KB, turn me on with a suggestion.
Sure, what's your suggestion?
Well, it's all kind of bulky. I've seen ones, people sneak chimney sweeping. They wear those masks with the charcoal filter in the front, one on each side. Will that block the virus? Because I know a charcoal filter will actually totally make air, stale air into fresh air. Will that work? And that's something else to mention also.
Okay, well, I haven't really read a lot on using activated carbon, but my gut feeling would be that it would probably not be as effective as a legitimate small pore filtration device, which it's not. The way that activated carbon works is it has a very, very large surface area per gram, and it absorbs a molecule. So what happens is it's primarily designed to get organic solvents and such out of your breathing air, where it can cause lung damage and provoke other toxic effects. So the activated carbon usually is not used alone. There is usually also a physical filtration device included as a cartridge, one way or the other, and then it would depend really on the pore size of those filters, whether or not it was effective for something like a virus.
Comment in one mighty way.
Thanks.
Yeah, a lot of painting filters were available in NR or P 95, 97.5, 99 filtration rates that they put in front of these filters, the organic filters for painting. And they're finding that these masks are relatively easy to clean and relatively easy to replace the filtration, whether it's oil resistant or not oil resistant, the R or the N. So people are starting to use those more and more in marine environments. And by that I mean places where you find them, painting environments, marine environments.
Okay, Hank, that's very good to know. So it is, but the point I was trying to make is that the activated charcoal really doesn't help in this situation. It's more for just organic molecules as opposed to viruses. But if the filtration system is equivalent to N95 or better, then all power to you. You have to, again, keep in mind that these particular masks require you to make a good seal through them. People with beards can be problematic because that kind of gives you gaps where the air can go through or around the filter. But if you have those type of filters and they can be fitted to your face, then feel free to use them.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to say these filters are placed in front of the charcoal filter or the volatile organic compound absorbing filter, and it's actually a two-stage filtration system depending upon who made the mask, 3M, AOS, things of that nature.
Well, I mean, ultimately, it doesn't really make that much a difference as far as the virus, whether the N95 or N97 type of a filter is before or after the activated charcoal. I just wanted to make sure that some people didn't think that activated charcoal was good for viral particles. That's all.
Net control?
Yes?
I had two questions. I don't know if this one was over, but about the mask. The double fabric, from what I understand, is going to keep anything that's inside of you in. Just think about what happens when you use a handkerchief, a cloth handkerchief, as opposed to a tissue. So your hands are going to get a little gross, but like you were saying, you don't want to touch it. The thing that I've found interesting is how many people have been walking around on the streets when there's masks, when there's supposedly a mask shortage. So that's just like a joke. But the M95, there's surgical level masks and non-surgical level masks. And I think everybody who's worried about what mask they need does not need a surgical level mask. Perhaps I'm wrong.
Unfortunately, you got that a little wrong. As I mentioned in the story, that surgical masks are not designed to keep the infection away from the surgeon. They're designed to keep the surgical staff from not infecting the open wounds during surgery. So surgical masks are not anything close to N95. They're not supposed to be form-fitted. There's no problem with beards or anything. They're a little bit better than the average paper and cloth that you see on the street, but not terribly more so. It's the things like N95 and in infectious disease hospitals. There was a lot of video on one particular one in, I believe, Milan, where they had a statistic that not one single healthcare provider in that hospital developed coronavirus because they were suited up like the Andromeda strain. So they had a much more stringent filtration system and protective gear than anyone outside of an infectious hospital does. But again, surgical masks aren't protective to the wearer. They're protective for the other people.
I understand that. My point being that it's not going to get out if you're wearing whatever mask. Chances are the bacteria is not going to get out onto the other people. The other question I had, though, was the concept with these modeling, when they keep saying the word modeling, is that just another word for hypothesis?
I guess you could say that. It basically amounts to an educated guess. These people are epidemiologists. They have spent, in some cases, like Anthony Fauci, something like 50 years, 79 years old these days, in the field, and they have designed models. Models are educated guesses based upon other outbreaks in general and other outbreaks of the coronavirus in China and Taiwan and Japan and Italy and Spain. Are they 100% legit? Absolutely not. They are educated guesses based on hopefully a good understanding of what's going on and of the previous numbers that they've gotten from victims of it.
So then by saying it's an educated guess, they could have used lower numbers or higher numbers based on the fact that China gave us data that we don't believe, correct? And that whatever the more accurate numbers would be are from Italy. And I wonder, since they say they're not getting the data, I'm wondering whether they're not getting the data from New York, because whenever I've been down there, I haven't seen people, you know, hanging out on lines outside of the hospital. So I'm very confused.
Okay, well, I don't know what to tell you about those lines. I've kind of seen videos. I don't think they're making it up. I've seen videos of the freezer trucks that have corpses in them. I see the numbers that are reported. I don't really think the mayor and other officials are going to BS us about people dying. Just about every night on my little cameras across the street, I see ambulances parking and picking people up. So I don't think it's a big show personally, but yes, they could suggest other numbers. I don't think they're suggesting their numbers all based on China, because I think a lot of people are a little dubious of China. But at this point, you have much more than China, as you mentioned. You have Spain, you have Italy, you have Taiwan, you have Japan. They're much more believable groups, and they have been ahead of the time curve that we are on right now. So I think it's reasonable to assume that these models that fit in Spain and Italy and such are reasonable to use.
Ah. To our two.
Okay, Lou first.
Okay, I think you understated the modeling concept a bit. These are statistical, mathematical models that they are using from the data that they have. And there are several pretty reliable websites where you can look at them and look at the breakdown. Of course, Johns Hopkins is a major one. There's another one by SAS, SAS.com, and some other things there. Of course, the data is only as reliable as what we have collected, and there's an awful lot of missing data here because of the insufficient testing of the population. Roy, it's to our cue.
Okay, Lou, I'm sorry if I gave the impression that this was just stuff they threw up on the wall to see if it would stick. These things are based on statistical analysis, but they are still modeling, and there are different models available. And very often you will see curves that are not just straight lines. They are shaded, two curves with shaded intermediate regions where the upper limit and the lower limit, depending upon the modeling method used. So, again, it's not a bunch of guys sitting on a rock thinking this stuff up. It's based on science and hundreds of years of history in epidemiology and some numbers that people generally tend to trust as opposed to the numbers that aren't very trusted. Also, if you go to my link page, roy.ac2gs.com, there are those YouTubes of a guy who sits there with an Excel sheet and kind of runs you through a beginner's guide to how the modeling sort of works. It's kind of a first grade level. It's not a PhD level, but at least it hopefully gives people a sense of what thoughts are going on when they're doing these modeling.
HYS query.
Okay, first Wesley, then unfortunately I did write down the other guy's call sign, and then Bill. So Wesley next.
Okay. So I'm not as smart, but I help myself. The size of coronavirus, 120 nanometers, is humongous. And comparing to what we can do with GCEM, it's humongous. It's, and from the description, the nuclear capsid made up of protein, shell known as capsid, and containing the viral nucleic acids, is helical or tubular.